I'm sure you're all familiar with word association games. If not by name, you at least know the kind of thing I mean. So, you know, you speak to someone and I might say the word bread to them. And they say the first word that comes into their heads. So I say bread and they might say butter. Or if it was me, someone might say staple food and I might say chocolate. You know, it's that kind of thing. And I reckon if you were to play that word association game with just about anybody, and you said to them, Daniel, the response would be something like lions, or lion's den, or den of lions. Because even people who know very little of the Bible, people who couldn't really articulate what the story of Daniel is about, or couldn't really tell you the fullness of the story of Daniel, if you spoke to them, they would be, so many at least, not by any means everyone in these days. There's plenty of people who've never heard enough to even know the name of Daniel, let alone the name of Jesus. But certainly for a lot of people, that is a one big story in Daniel that people associate Daniel with. The lion's den is to Daniel what Goliath is to David. It's what the whale is to Jonah. You sometimes imagine if the likes of Jonah and David and Daniel, if they ever kind of felt, if they were able to see how people consider them these days, I think they would like to say, there was more to me than that. There's lots of other stories surrounding each of them. But certainly, this is the biggie in the book of Daniel. So the question comes, what's it all about? Why is it such a big story? It's well known, of course, because it's quite an adventure. You can guarantee, if you take a child and you tell them the story of Daniel and the Den of Lions, they'll enjoy it. They'll love the suspense of this man potentially being torn to pieces. I'm sure that's the way my kids would look on it. And then, of course, being rescued and all of that is a graphic and it's a wonderful story. But what's it all about in the sense of asking, and what we need to ask this evening, what does God want you and I to take from it? Is it just there to be an enjoyable, graphic, gripping story? Well, of course, everything God tells us in the Bible, in the bits that seem maybe a little duller, in the bits that are harder to get excited about, and in these really exciting stories, God's always trying to tell us something. He's always trying to do something in your life and in mine. So that's what we're looking at this evening. I must have had a nap in the afternoon, I think it's the morning. So what are the lessons we can learn? And I'm just going to work through some. The first one, and I think this is a very important one, is we learn that there is great encouragement for the... what's the best way to put this? Not for the older people, that's not right. There's great encouragement for the less young. Does that work? That's not offensive to anyone. There's great encouragement for the less young. What I mean by that is, now this is from a series that I did at Grace Community Church on the book of Daniel. And I remember going through these first chapters being so deeply encouraged at how God speaks to the youth. You know, I was thinking it was so great to be able to say to the young people, here's some stuff that's obviously it's for everyone, but it's so specific to you. Here's a young teenager being taken out of his comfort zone, being taken out of his land, his people, his language, and everything he holds dear and everything familiar to him, and being brought to a foreign land to be trained in foreign ways, in foreign religion, in foreign language. Every morning he's waking up, you can just imagine him waking up half dreaming about home and seeing his family and hearing their voices, and he wakes up and he looks around him and he would have seen idols and he would have seen, heard language that was unfamiliar, and he would have been reminded of it. And yet the whole emphasis on these first chapters is that this young teenager takes such an incredible firm stand for God even in the midst of all that, that he just does incredible wonders. God does these wonders through him. God shows himself through him. It's a reminder to teenagers. It's a reminder to children. It's a reminder to really young adults like myself. It's a reminder to all of us, really. Daniel stood when it was a choice of standing for God and having an incredibly hard life or having an easy life by disowning God. And he chose God every time. So did his other young friends, Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego. So it's great to see that. But here's the interesting thing. When I did a Google search, because it's nice to see how people visualize stories. So go on to Google. For the old folk like Roddy, you just Google. And then you go on and you can click image search and type in Daniel Lion's Den. And it's incredible what comes up. Because the pictures, it's all pictures that come up that way. You'll have Daniel about 11 or 12 years old facing these lions. Or you'll have Daniel as a teenager facing these lions. Or some of them, I think the oldest ones I saw, he was about mid-20s maybe. And he's standing there with all these fluffy looking smiley lions in front of him. That's the way people have drawn the stories. So when people visualize Daniel in the lion's den, they have this idea of that young man Daniel faced with these lions. The truth of the matter is, and you can work it easily through the history of one king taking over after another, Daniel was roughly 80 years old as he stood faced with these lions. Daniel was not a spring chicken. He was one of the less young people. And I think it's amazing that after we've had in the first few chapters all this great encouragement for the young folk, and it's good, but it almost tends sometimes that we really focus on the young people. Now that's absolutely right. We know that, and I know that as older people we get to know it more. We've got to encourage the young people, but it's also good to remind us that here Daniel is standing, roughly 80 years old, has proved God in all kinds of ways through his life, but here he is showing that he's going to keep standing for God, even in his later years. God isn't just interested in the next generation, although he is massively interested in them. He's interested in the older generations right now. The thing is, as an older person, you can decide whether you want to put yourselves in the category or not. As an older person, we can slacken off in all kinds of ways in life. I mean, if you're older, you don't have to... I feel awful sometimes. And some of the people I'm talking about are in here. I feel awful. I drive through Kyle and I barely seem to be out of my car. Like, I'm always in my car if I'm going from one place to another. And there's certain people that I pass and they're of that older generation and they're always walking. And it always makes me feel bad. Makes me feel bad when I'm in Elgol and I see Ian trudging about after sheep and things, and I'm thinking, oh, I feel tired just looking out the window at him. There's things you're allowed to slacken off in. You can send Donald out to do all the work with the sheep. You know what I mean? There's things that absolutely are fine. No one will say anything against you if you slacken off in. You don't have to do so much exercise, although of course it's good for you. You don't have to do all kinds of things. But here's one thing that I plead with you not to slacken off on. Your devotion to God. And all the ways that that manifests itself. And I plead with you because, now I'm probably be really touch and go here. As a younger person, not young, but younger, we need the inspiration that we get from the older people. We really need it. What inspires us is when we see other people, and it's countless times I've looked at people and I've looked at Christians and I've heard older Christians pray, or I've heard older Christians their story, or I've seen just the gentleness, the graciousness, these features in their lives, and countless times it's kept me inspired to say, I just would love to grow older like that. growing in grace. And so on behalf of everyone my age and lower, I want to implore everyone older, please, for our sakes, keep leading us in a godly example. Don't ease off from setting us an example of what godly faithfulness looks like. I think that's one of the important lessons here, because we see Daniel, 80 years old roughly, he's still a man of constant prayer, he's still a man who's willing to risk his neck for the sake of God's name, he's still a man who is known for his trustworthiness, his integrity, he's still totally dependable. And he sets this great example, and I think that this must be one of the reasons that he decides to ignore the prayer ban. So think of it like this. Daniel is this kind of elder statesman within the church. And there's this ban on praying, and it's almost, you could almost think, well, maybe Daniel will think, do you know what? For 80 years I've been risking everything, and I just want a bit of, I just want to sit down sometimes and leave it to the young folk. So maybe this is their time to stand for God. Maybe I'll just go sit and put my feet up. I'll stay away from the window and pray. Or I'll sit at the window and I'll pray silently without moving my lips. But Daniel decides he can't do that. And I think, perhaps reading into it too much, but I'm pretty sure one of the reasons he did it is because he knew that there were generations and generations below him who were all looking up to him. And he knew, how would it have been if Daniel, the most known believer in the true God, if he had decided to slack off? Well, guaranteed, every younger believer would have said, well, look, Daniel reckons it's okay not to pray for a few weeks. Surely we can do the same. But instead, he chooses to set them a godly example at potentially the cost of his own life. A lot rested on whether he would follow God or not. And the same is true today. Live in such a way, please, for our sakes, that when we're wondering what to do, how to respond to things in the world, how to respond to challenges, we look up and we think, well, what are those older Christians doing? I mean, they walked with God their whole lives. What decisions are they taking? And we look up and we continue to see that wonderful faithfulness. So that's one lesson. There's this encouragement for those of a certain age. It's the same lesson we read off in Psalm 92, these lovely verses. The righteous flourish like a palm tree and grow like a cedar in Lebanon. They are planted in the house of the Lord. They flourish in the courts of God. They still bear fruit in old age. They are ever full of sap and green to declare that the Lord is upright. So continue to bear fruit in old age. You got that, Cammy? Old age is, sorry, I'll not go down that route. But be encouraged, those who are of a certain age. But the next lesson we learn is that there's encouragement here to seek integrity, because one of the things you are blasted with as you read through the book of Daniel is this guy's solid, absolute trustworthiness and integrity. Regardless of the age that we find him at in the different phases of his life. Now Ephesians tells us in chapter 1 that before God we are to be, he's chosen us before the foundation of the world, that we should be holy and blameless before him. God has absolutely no expectation that you or I will be perfect. God knows what we're like. God knows our complete lack of imperfection. We're to be striving to be holy and blameless. And I think there's a sense of blameless here. Daniel wasn't perfect. Only Jesus was perfect. The Bible is not telling us Daniel was perfect, but there's this sense of blamelessness in the sense that people who, his life is this open book that as people read it, they won't be able to find anything at which they can point at Daniel and say, you see, this is what he's really like. And if there is, he'll be able to turn around to them and say, well, You know, he will have confessed it. He will have repented from it. His life is this open book of integrity and blamelessness. You see, what happened is at the end of the last chapter, the kingdom had fallen to the Medes and Persians, combined empire, and the new king comes on the throne, and this king, Darius, he has never heard of any, he doesn't know any of the people there, but as he talks to everyone, trying to find out who he can rely on and set as in charge of the place, one name stands out. And you see how much Daniel's name stands out as being overwhelmingly positive in reputation. So firstly, Darius sets up 120 satraps, leaders of the nation. Everything's under these 120 men. But then he decides that out of them he's going to set three really important men who are overseeing them. And one of them he picks Daniel to be. And then out of the three, he decides he's going to pick the most trustworthy one of them to oversee the three. And he picks Daniel. Now, looking into this, what the commentators reckon is going on is that it seems the king's money and taxes were under threat from these 120 satraps. There seems to have been, now, you'll be shocked to hear this, living in a great day like ours. It seems that there was a lack of integrity in the leaders at that time. It seems bizarrely that there were corrupt people in government back then. I'll resist making any comment on our own day. But King Darius takes these three men, they're in charge of the 120, and it's as if he's putting them and ultimately Daniel in a place where they make sure they're not stealing from the king's purse. And then the people go because they don't like someone standing between them and the king's money. So these satraps decide they've got to get rid of Daniel. And they decide to find out what he's done wrong that they can accuse him of before the king. And it's like, you can imagine it, if it was today, they'd be bugging his phone, they'd be, tapping his phone and bugging the room, and they'd be doing what other covert surveillance they do and that you see in all these programs. Back these days, I don't know how they did it, short of just hiding behind doors and listening against walls and asking everyone who knew anything about Daniel, desperate to dig up the dirt on him. And they found absolutely nothing. There was no dirt to be dug. And here in verse 10, I think this is the greatest miracle of this chapter. We're hearing this morning just wonderfully about miracles and about how God intervenes in these great ways to change situations and intervenes in ways that only God can. In Daniel, you look at it and on the surface, the greatest miracle is that you throw a man into a den of hungry lions and they don't eat him. I mean, that is a huge miracle. But there's an even greater miracle here. And this is it. It's the great miracle of verse 10. Daniel learned that the decree had been published, and he went home and prayed, just like he always had done. The miracle of God working in this guy's heart, so that even with the prospect of his own gruesome death, he chooses to follow God just as he always had done. That is miraculous. These weren't lions with full stomachs. They weren't tame lions. Remember when they threw in those who had accused Daniel, before they hit the ground, their bones are crushed by the teeth of the lions. So anyway, we have Daniel's faithfulness. And then just rattling through the rest of the things, we have encouragement towards prayer. We have encouragement towards prayer. Daniel is told that he's not to pray or else he'll face the den of lions, and he decides that he will gladly face the den of lions rather than face a life without prayer. He knows from his experience that prayer works. And Daniel, this is the amazing thing to me, Daniel sees prayer as more valuable and more important than life itself. I say that and then I ask myself, are there times when I don't even see prayer as more valuable and important than TV? Are there times when I don't see prayer as more valuable and important than just resting and doing nothing? Because our habits show what we find most valuable in life. And you see with Daniel that prayer is a habit. It's not a ritualistic thing. It's not something that he's just going, you know, kind of pulled along by the thought of, well, I've got to tick off that I've prayed three times today. It's nothing like that. It's his whole life revolves around prayer. You get the idea that if Daniel was doing you get these big day planners, and you write all the things in, right? You start off, this is how most people would write their days. This is how I would probably go about it. I think, well, I need to spend some time working, so I'll work from, 12 o'clock to 1 o'clock or whatever. You put in the time that you've got to work, and then you start putting other things. Well, I've got to rest, so I'll have some relaxing time there. And then I've got to spend time with the family, or they'll complain, so I'll put in some time for the family there. And you put in all these other things onto the day planner, and at the end of it you think, is there time for prayer? And if there's a little spare gap, then we'll maybe go through and think if there's anything else we've missed. And then at the end, we might just add prayer. And if there's room for it, that's great. And if not, that's... Now, obviously, we don't write day planners like that. But that's almost how we often live our lives in practice. I get the impression that if Daniel was doing his day planner, I imagine him every day of his life, he just gets a new one for that year. January 1st, he opens up, someone's given it... Well, not quite, but whenever he gets his new present, day planner, and he goes through every single day, and he writes 7 a.m. pray, 12 p.m. pray, 5 p.m. pray, and then, or whatever it is, and he just goes through every single day, and he puts in the prayer times, and he basically thinks, you know what, I've got to spend time with God. That's the big thing. Anything else can be fitted around that. I think that's the kind of priority he shows here. He did in verse 10, when he went back to pray, he didn't just go there to make a show for the people. It wasn't just to make a kind of standing point of saying, well, I'm going to pray and I'm going to sit at the window and do it. It says here in verse 10, just as he had done before. It was his daily routine. Prayer was his life. Not just when the huge dilemma came here, but every single day. Two more lessons very quickly. One of them is that as we read through Daniel, right through the book, it always stands out the rise and fall of nations and rulers, contrasted with the stability of God and his people throughout history. So you start Daniel off. This is one of the things I think is absolutely amazing. You start Daniel off, and in the very first verses it talks about King Nebuchadnezzar. And the king, the whole thing is, it takes King Nebuchadnezzar is a great king, at that time the greatest king over all the earth, the king of the biggest nation. And it introduces him, and then it introduces a little unimportant teenager. And then you go forward chapter after chapter after chapter, and you see Nebuchadnezzar's whole kingdom and himself down. And then you see other kings come in. And there's his downfall and rising up of kings and of nations. And then right through it, right to the very end, you see Daniel, a young man following God, following God, following God, faithfully God's kingdom and God's people, steadfast through the changing scenes of history. And that's a great encouragement, I believe, in a day, in a generation like ours, where we sometimes, when we often get worried about the state of the church, or we get worried about what is happening to Christianity and all of these things, we realize as you look back through all of history that it's always been the same. There's a rise and there's a fall of kingdoms and nations and of rulers and of religious trends and everything else. And then right through history, you're right through, especially just looking from the cross, is this a steady group, starting with that early church. And, oh, of course, the church has its ups, and the church certainly has its downs. We have our times of faithlessness, but always God's people are keep going, serving Him, following Him, and that's what we ought to do, trusting always that whatever happens with nations, with rulers, with huge world events, God's kingdom will continue. I reckon, I don't know, again, I'm using sort of speculating a little bit, but I love to try and imagine things in these stories and picture them. And I'm thinking of what Daniel's mindset was like, and I try and imagine him in verse 10. Daniel learned that the decree had been published. And it says very little, it just says he went home to his upstairs room where the window opened toward Jerusalem. And he's 80 years old, and just the kind of person he is, this is how I imagine it, right? I actually imagine him a little bit like one of the old lecturers in Cornhill College, who is just the most calm, godly, lovely Christian man. And I imagine Daniel like him, and he kind of hears someone says, okay, now from now on, if you pray, you'll get thrown to the lions. And it's, I almost imagine that he's got this mindset of, okay, God, here we go again. This has been a regular occurrence throughout my life. Follow the king, whatever kingdom it is, whatever king happens to be on the throne, he probably has to check. Maybe he's getting a little older, he's thinking, who's on the throne just now? Is it, you know, it's not Nebuchadnezzar, it's that Darius now. Follow his rules or you'll be killed. And he thinks, well, all of my life I've chosen to follow God. He's never let me down. So I'll just, you know, there's no point worrying about it. I'll head back home. He takes his seat and he just starts praying. I imagine there was no great drama in it. It's not that he's saying, oh no, what's going to happen here? It's just, he's been through this time and time again. And yet he knows that whatever happens to him, God's kingdom will not fail, whether he lives or whether he dies. The last lesson, sorry for rattling through this, the last lesson is this. God saves. Our God saves. Listen to the words of this. Bear in mind, this is the ungodly king who's known virtually nothing about Daniel's God. And he's seen what's happened, and he sums it up by sending a letter around the whole kingdom after the example of this 80-year-old man. And in verse 27, he says of God, he rescues and he saves. And that is a great way of summing up maybe the greatest lesson of this chapter. Our God saves. Now the lesson isn't that God always saves his people from situations of danger. The lesson isn't that when God's people are faced with the imminent possibility of death for their following of him, God will always jump in and save them. The lesson is not that the lion's mouths will always remain closed. We know that from history. We know that many people, brothers and sisters throughout the world, who have become martyrs in similar and identical ways, who have been faced with lions, who have gone faithfully to the lions, and who have been killed by the lions. We know of people who've gone to furnaces, and God didn't step in like he did with Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego and save them. There was that fourth man in the fire, but the people who in these situations died. So the lesson is not that God will always save, but the lesson is our God saves. And if he chooses not to save his people from the teeth of the lion, then he will save them through the teeth of the lion in an even more glorious way. So that even through the horror of death, they will be saved into the bliss of eternal and glorious life. Resurrection to life beyond anything they could ever have dreamed of. So that these people who in their imagination as they're faced with the death of a lion or whatever it is, literally, they think, they try and imagine, what will it be like when I see my God face to face? What will it be like when I'm in his presence? And no matter how wonderful an image they conjured up, the Bible tells us that no eye has seen, no ear has heard, neither has the heart of man conceived what it will be like in that moment. It's beyond our wildest dreams. And so God will either save his people from the lions or through the lions. And often it is through the lions. But the lesson remains the same. The lesson is this: our God is a God who saves. He's a God who rescues. And we need to remember that, because he saves, of course, in many different ways. But above everything, the wonderful number one way that we all know he saves is that he saves his people from our sin. He saves us from the fear of death. He saves us from the grip of Satan. He saves us from the condemnation that will lead to eternal punishment. And he does that for every person who will call on his name. Any single person in this building, whatever our history to this point is, the moment we call out on Jesus, our God saves you right then, right there, and forever. Our God saves. Does Daniel remind you of anyone? He was a man who lived a faithful life to God, yet he was despised and rejected. And ultimately his enemies plotted a complicated plan to put him to death. He chose to go God's way, even though that way would mean giving himself up to death. He was placed into the darkness of that den. Stone was laid over the entrance to seal the den so he couldn't get out. When they came at morning time, in between the episodes, and the king came to find him, they discovered that he was in fact alive. A miracle had happened. Death had not had the victory. And one day God would save in the greatest way possible. He would send his perfect, blameless son, the one who was perfect, to be despised, rejected, condemned to death, plotted against, crucified, laid in the grave, stone laid over the entrance, only to find out on Easter morning that death could not hold Jesus, that he was alive, and that he is available as Saviour and as Lord. Our God saves.